Right, how to get on with people. Everyone finds themselves in dispute with someone else from time to time. It seems to be a condition of the human life that there is always someone around us ready to push your buttons, either knowingly or sometimes blithely unaware that they're doing so. You get angry and frustrated with somebody else's behaviour, perhaps, or get blamed for something. And before you know it, you're caught up in a game of highly charged emotional ping pong. The problem is that whilst each side in any dispute clings to the belief that they are in the right, accusations, justifications, and condemnations continue to fly to and fro. And with them come plenty of painful feelings. What is not seen or understood at such times is that a defensive stance is usually perceived from the outside as aggressive. This perception of aggression creates fear, anxiety, and painful feelings in the observer, who, quite naturally enough, feels the need to defend his or herself. Thus, they too adopt a defensive stance, which in turn is perceived as aggressive from the other side, and so it goes on. And on, around and around, with each side defending themselves and disputing with the other endlessly. Disputes run on internally in a similar vein. You mentally churn over the same old stories again and again, for hours, days, weeks, even years, forever trying to prove the rights and wrongs of it all. This is what, in Buddhism, we call clinging attachment, and it is very painful. The question is, how do you break this vicious circle of cause and effect? One popular technique, tried by human beings down the ages, is to do absolutely everything in one's power to ensure coming out on top by suppressing the opponent. Or, conversely, doing everything possible to suppress the forces of conflict within oneself. The trouble with any form of suppression is that the underlying conflict has not actually been resolved and will inevitably flare up again as soon as the lid comes off. Out of sight, maybe, but not out of mind, not really. Many people adopt a reasonable compromise. In effect, they agree to disagree and to make allowances for the differing views and aspirations of others. This works well in the main, but as we have witnessed with the recent inner city riots and their aftermath, we cannot rely on such reasonable attitudes being maintained by everyone all the time. In the Pali Canon, there is a discourse called the Parable of the Saw, in which the Buddha gives a teaching on this very subject of how to get on with people. It is a beautiful teaching full of stories, analogies, and illustrations that carry within them a store of wisdom that explains how to overcome such conflicts. The occasion for this particular teaching was a feud that broke out in the Buddha's own monastic order. The monk, Mollyapagana, had become very friendly with a group of nuns. Too friendly, according to the other monks, who felt that he spent far too much time with them, gossiping and joking and making fun of serious monastic offences. To make matters worse, Mollyapagana and the nuns would defend themselves to the hilt when being reprimanded. They would become angry and started to cause trouble during formal meetings of the order. They would disparage the other recluses and accuse them of breaking the rules. The Buddha was greatly concerned when he heard what was going on within his order. A full-time monastic community can only flourish if its members willingly abide by the rules that govern it, both in the spirit and the letter, and behave towards one another with consideration. The community also depends for its survival on the generosity of its lay following. Who on earth would wish to support a Buddhist monastery where rivalry and bickering were routinely in evidence? Having Molyo Pugna summoned and seated respectfully before the entire order, the Buddha asked if the reports about his behaviour were true. The monk replied that they were, and then the Buddha asked whether the monk, who was from a respectable family, had left the household life and entered the order out of faith in his teaching. The monk replied that he had. Only now, with these facts established, did the Buddha rebuke the monk, telling him that his behaviour was not suitable, given that he chose to live his life as a recluse. The Buddha then explained what was expected of Molyo Pugna as a monk, saying that even if, face to face, dispraise was spoken with regard to either himself or to the nuns, the monk was to rid himself of any worldly thoughts and desires that arose. "You, Pugna," said the Buddha, "must train yourself thus. Neither will my mind become perverted, nor will I utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate, I will dwell with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred." The Buddha reinforced the point by stating the same should hold true even if someone should give a blow with the hand, a clod of earth, a stick, or with any other kind of weapon. The Buddha then shifted his attention from the errant monk and addressed the order as a whole to help turn all their minds in a positive direction. He reflected on how it was that at one time his monks were truly accomplished in mind. Even when he laid down the rule of training to only eat a full meal once a day, the monks did not complain, and he was able to instruct them easily in how to practice mindfulness. The Buddha therefore encouraged his monks to get rid of what is unskilled and to make exertion among the things that are skilled, so that they might come to growth, development, and maturity in his teaching. The Buddha always maintained that mindfulness was the one way out of suffering, and was therefore the touchstone for his entire teaching. Mindfulness contains the properties of wakefulness, clarity, and honesty. It is a lucid awareness, one that is not being judgmental or critical, but is simply alive to real-time events as they occur in order to understand them. It is a mind that is soft, pliable, spacious, and accepting. However, the reality is that all unenlightened beings possess attachments of many different kinds. When life is not as one would want it, a passionate resistance arises that, if rigidly clung to, can deteriorate into out-and-out hatred, with all the pain and heartache that comes with it. At such times, the mind is so caught up in clinging attachment that there is no possibility of mindfulness being established at all. To illustrate, consider a meditator on retreat who is forever complaining about the food, the mattress, the central heating, the traffic noise, fellow meditators. How is a meditator to succeed in calming the mind with habitual mental behaviour like this? We have found, over the years, that those on retreat who willingly accept conditions as they are, without complaint, are the ones who settle into their practice the best and reap the most benefit. They are not at odds with the world, the teaching, or the teacher. And with time and application, they find that the mind settles into a calm and spacious state. But how is this accomplished? The Buddha used the analogy of a great wood that has been overrun with creepers. A man wishing to return the wood to its former glory sets to work, removing the creepers and any damaged tree sprouts. He clears the inside of the wood and tends properly those tree sprouts that are straight and healthy, giving them the space they need to grow. Thus, after a time, the wood comes to growth, development, and maturity. This is what the Buddha calls right effort. It is the effort to abandon and restrain unwholesome states of mind, and to cultivate and maintain good states, and by so doing, establish a mind settled and spacious enough to deal with even the most trying of conditions. However, the cultivation of the mind in this way can only be accomplished if you have initially accepted the reality of your own mental behaviour. You can only restrain inefficient mental qualities such as enmity, envy, or conceit once it is acknowledged that they are present. Otherwise, such negative qualities continue to fester and grow in the darkness of willful ignorance. In his discourse, the Buddha tells the monks a story about the lady householder Wedehika and her servant Kali to explain the point. The lady householder Wedehika had a reputation for being gentle, meek, and tranquil. Her servant Kali began to wonder whether Wedehika actually had a bad temper, but did her best not to show it. Kali decided to test her mistress by getting up late each morning and speaking discourteously when her bad behaviour was pointed out. Each day, Kali got up later than the day before, and each day Wedehika became angrier, until one day she finally exploded and struck Kali across the head with a bolt from the door. The servant, with her head broken and blood streaming, went from door to door around the neighbourhood, exclaiming that her so-called gentle, meek and tranquil mistress had struck her with a door bolt for getting up late. From then on, Wedehika's reputation went downhill. You cannot fool all the people all the time. We communicate not just with words, but with our body and our minds also. Inner attitudes are transmitted externally, and people will generally feel uneasy around those who harbour thoughts that are less than friendly. They may not necessarily be able to consciously recognise what is happening, but they will be picking up the signals nonetheless. In the same way that the servant Kali tested her mistress, there sometimes emerges a strong urge to bait such an individual in order to induce a more honest and realistic reaction. Even if that response is angry and aggressive, it will be much preferred, precisely because it is a more truthful reflection of what they are really thinking and feeling. For the meditator to acknowledge that they have negative mental habits may well be painful. But as was mentioned earlier, the way of suppression cannot resolve conflict. Merely keeping up external appearances will never be enough. What is required is to adopt an intelligent and mature attitude, one of inner honesty, faith, and courage, a willingness to look at aspects of the mind hitherto deemed unacceptable and ignored. To be fully awake to whatever is present and to accept the simple truth of that moment. The Buddha pointed out that the true test of a student's development is not so much when things are going well, but rather when they are not. The acid test is how you react when your buttons are being pushed or when being spoken to in ways that you do not like. The Buddha gave a list of 10 ways that people might speak to us, or how we might speak to others. These are at a right time or a wrong time, according to fact or not according to fact, gently or harshly, on what is connected to the goal of the Buddha's teaching or on what is not connected to it, with a mind of friendliness or a mind full of hatred. Generally, people are honest, but I'm sure everyone can remember occasions when they have been less than entirely truthful. So too with all the other conditions mentioned. The Buddha is simply pointing out that as we speak and behave, so do others. We are not really so very different from one another. It is actually very helpful when trying to restrain a negative response to take mindful notice of what kind of speech is being uttered. Perhaps someone is speaking the truth, but harshly, or speaking about the Buddha's teaching, but at the wrong time. Or perhaps you recognize, even in hindsight, that you spoke with a mind of friendliness on one occasion, but not on another. The Buddha urged his monks with the same exhortation he gave Mollyapugana. Whenever confronted with unwelcome speech, to train themselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate we will dwell with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred. But here the Buddha adds another clause. To dwell suffusing that person with a mind of friendliness, and beginning with him or her, to dwell having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. This is metta, or loving-kindness, an essential practice for all Buddhist meditators. Time tonight does not allow for a detailed summary of how to formally develop this wonderful mental quality. There are plenty of recorded lectures and books describing how to practice, and personal interviews are always available. Developing a loving attitude is not restricted to just formal seated practice. Any occasion where you care for others is developing the right kind of mindset. Giving a gift, for instance, is a very good practical way of overcoming a feeling of enmity towards someone. It needs to be remembered, though, that you do not give a gift in an attempt to appease the other person. You do not practice metta towards them to try to get them to change their attitude. Such behaviour would simply be developing more hatred, but now in the guise of friendliness. The idea is to develop the culture of one's own mind, to develop a mind of friendliness that is, as the Buddha states, far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence, and without expecting anything in return. The mind that is full of metta radiates good feeling. It is the opposite of someone who is indulging in negativity. Someone developing metta finds that the social barriers come down, that they attract others to them, and that social interactions are smoother, softer, and more cordial. Whatever a person chooses to radiate mentally will undoubtedly be reflected back to them. To illustrate the effect that developing metta can have in helping us deal with difficult relationships, the Buddha used a series of analogies. Could someone, using a shovel and basket, digging up the earth and tossing it all around, by that act, make the great earth disappear? Could someone, throwing coloured powders into the air, make shapes appear in the sky? Could someone, with a burning grass torch, set fire to the river Ganges? Could someone with a bag made of cat skin bashing it with a piece of wood or stroking it, make that catskin bag either hiss or purr. Could such a thing happen? He asked his monks. No, they replied. Anyone would be worn out and defeated long before any such thing could occur. The effect of developing metta is similar, said the Buddha. No matter what kind of speech is encountered, whether it is gross or subtle, the mind remains deep, immeasurable, spacious, silky and supple. No matter what is thrown at that mind, whether intentional or accidental, the mind filled with loving kindness can endure the painful thoughts and feelings that arise without responding negatively. The Buddha summarized the ideal attitude for those who practice his way with his famous parable of the saw. He said, "Monks, as low-down thieves might carve one limb from limb with a double-handled saw, yet even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity, he for this reason is not a doer of my teaching." This statement is unequivocal, and perhaps some might feel a little daunted by the thought of trying to live up to such high standards of personal restraint. But this, I believe, would be to misunderstand the Buddha's point. The key phrase here is, whoever sets his mind at enmity. To believe that no negative thoughts should ever enter one's mind is entirely unrealistic. Given that you have previously responded to undesirable situations with displeasure, resentment, defensiveness, and anger, it is inevitable that, given similar conditions, these kinds of thoughts will arise now. This is the nature of the condition-dependent origination of things. Past volitional actions and present supporting conditions are all that are required for such thoughts to arise now. This is not personal, and there is no question of apportioning blame. These are just the natural laws that condition how mind and matter operate. There is no choice at this stage. There is nothing that can be done to prevent the arising of negative thoughts, any more than it is possible to be carved limb from limb and not experience acute painful feelings. So what does this parable mean then? What the Buddha alludes to with the phrase, whoever sets his mind at enmity, is not the initial negativity arising upon the painful feelings. It is rather the volitional activity that occurs subsequent to it. It is useful to recognize that there are two phases to this sequence, the passive phase and the active phase. The passive phase is the one we have just discussed. It means that the unwanted speech, the painful feelings, and negative responses simply occur and then cease. But what is critical is what happens next. It is now that the active volitional phase in the cycle begins. This is where choice is made. It is now that the mind picks up the initial negative response and, with the sense of self fully engaged, begins to indulge similar thoughts again and again. This is now new, fresh volitional activity. It is kamma, and will therefore produce results, both immediately and in the future. This is what the Buddha's phrase is concerned with. It is the point at which the painful feelings and unwanted perceptions are resisted and craving for life to be different begins. This is where one sets one's mind at enmity, and it is here where the Buddha's teaching on action and result is forgotten, and the darkness of ignorance sets in. It is here that such resistance is reinforced with all the justifications, condemnations, and self-defense. It is here that clinging attachment sets in. It is here that negativity, communicated through body, speech, and mind, begins radiating aggression and generating further suffering for oneself and others. How then do you cut through the cycles of perpetual conflict and clinging attachment? How do you end the game of emotional ping-pong once it is up and running? It can only be at the moment you become mindful and fully awake to the negative states that are present. Such states can be recognized because of the painful feelings, resistance, and general restlessness that will be present. It requires genuine honesty about what is taking place, but the payback is the ability to then restrain acting further upon those negative emotions. This requires a willingness to remain with the unpleasant feelings and the sense of injustice or insecurity that remain. It is only when you are able to see the transient nature of such thoughts and feelings that you are free of the problem. You need to be able to watch carefully and stay with all those horrible feelings and watch as they slowly break up and die away. The art lies in voluntarily accepting the situation as it is without trying to resolve it. This is difficult, and the process is helped tremendously by a long-term commitment to developing a mental culture of wakefulness and friendliness. A soft, lucid mind can take life's blows so much more easily. It also requires an equally long-term commitment to developing insight meditation in order to come to directly comprehend the truth of transience in all conditioned and conditioning things. We all make mistakes. Of course, no one can get this right 100% of the time. Indeed, the fact of getting it wrong from time to time is actually an advantage, for it allows the process of learning to carry on. It is extremely useful to remember that negative thinking is bound to arise. It is an habitual pattern. If you are mindful and self-possessed, the arising of such negativity can be a signal to pay attention to the painful thoughts and feelings and to simply watch them fade away. The Buddha said that mind is the forerunner of all things. All disputes have their origin within the mind. To understand this and to work on the culture of your own minds is wisdom, and such efforts will have a tremendous and positive effect on the world around you. Through learning how to restrain the self-defense mechanism within yourself, you will find that the external aggression you are confronted with will dissipate and fade. External aggression depends on your defensiveness to perpetuate it. Without that condition, it just falls away. The Buddha asked his monks if they were to attend repeatedly to his exhortation on the parable of the saw, would they see any way of speech, subtle or gross, that they could not endure? No, replied the monks. Wherefore, monks, said the Buddha, consider repeatedly this exhortation on the parable of the saw. For a long time, it will be for your welfare and happiness. Thank you very much.